to ride my bicycle. I want to ride my bike. I want to ride my bicycle. I want to ride it where I like.
The views expressed in this program do not reflect the views of the staff, management, or licensee of this station. This is 91.7 FM WHUS Stores. I am Peddlin' Ron, and you are listening to Bicycle Talk, episode 384. I think I didn't change my number. To be broadcast on February 28th, 2024 on WHUS 91.7 FM and WHUS.org. Welcome to Bicycle Talk with my friendly co-host, the lovely Dr. Fran Storch, who's in the other room, but she'll be here soon. If you're watching on Facebook Live, please feel free to comment down here below, and Fran or I will get back to you as soon as we can. Bicycle Talk is a show where we talk about bicycles, bicycle culture, bicycle advocacy, the upcoming news in cycling, the bicycle business, and the bicycle calendar. And I'm getting a weird message here. If you have a comment or you'd like to contribute information to the show and you're listening on Facebook Live, you can comment on the Bicycle Talk Facebook page, or you can email me at bicycletalk1@gmail.com. You can also listen to past episodes of Bicycle Talk on WHUS.org, iTunes, Spotify, and now on my Bicycle Talk YouTube channel. Ron's Rant of the Week. Yeah, I keep tabling this thing from a few weeks back, but we're back and we're going to do it this time for real. Why every e-biker should be worried about New Jersey's proposed micro-mobility insurance law. Don't even get me started. So there's a New Jersey bill to require micro-mobility users, we're talking about people who ride e-bikes and also scooters and other various things, to carry a form of liability insurance that doesn't even exist yet, but will be the first step down a slippery slope of erroneous requirements that have devastating consequences even for the exclusive human-powered modes, advocates say. My comment? Hey, New Jersey and your corporate greedy insurance industry, get your head out of your tailpipes and get a clue. I said it. And did you know, in the did you know department, walking in Los Angeles is so dangerous that more pedestrians were killed last year on Vermont Avenue than in the entire state of Vermont? Really? And advocates of Measure HLA are using that fact to urge voters to force the city to build a better infrastructure. Well, good. That's a good thing. But you know what? Really? More people killed on Vermont Avenue than in the state of Vermont? Give me a break. Okay, let's go to the positive side. All right. The International Drivers Association, how a simple pause slashes accident rates by 47%. Let's just back up here just a second. Maybe if the people on Vermont Avenue in Los Angeles would slow down a little bit, then maybe less people would get hit. Anyway, slowing down saves lives is no longer an idle lecture for reckless drivers, citing a groundbreaking study by the Federal Highway Administration that says it ties a humble intersection delay to 47% drop in pedestrian conflicts. So, for those of you who are out there driving motorized vehicles, if you're approaching an intersection or if you're in an intersection, slow down. This is not rocket science. This is common sense. Okay. Anyway, if we get a chance, I will talk a little bit more about that in the show because, you know, they're missing more in the show. And then on Mechanical Minute and Cycling Tips, I have here a couple things. From the pits, this is kind of interesting. This is from the pits of cycling news because this was kind of opening weekend for some of the classics and the monument races that start out in the spring over in Europe. And so there are some things that are observed and trending from the pits. And let me see if I can find that little link there because it's kind of fun. And I'll fill you in on what was seen in the pits. So what this is basically it's a casual observation of of what's going on with the bicycles that people are racing on, which is kind of cool. And so here is it. Six Tech 10 trends from opening weekend. So we had a couple of big races from this weekend. The Umloop and the Kuren were this weekend. And I'll have a little bit more information on that when we get into the bicycle racing section of Bicycle Talk, if we have time, and let you know about who's kicking serious butt on bicycles early season. But anyway, let's talk a little bit more about what was observed in the pits, which is kind of an interesting thing. First of all, first things first, with rims now being optimized for 30C tires, more teams are using wider tires. This also means more comfort with more effective tubeless setups. So yeah, the tires are getting wider. How about that? So what was the big number last year? 28C tires. That seemed to be like a thing. Everybody was going on 28s. I've been pushing 28s for a while now because they're just way more comfortable and you don't have as much air pressure in them. So that's kind of a thing. And it's a real thing. So using a 30C tire would have been unheard of a few years back. I mean, why would you want to put a big, fat, heavy tire on your racing bike? Well, there's a lot of reasons why. As a matter of fact, I don't know if I reported this last week or not. I may have. I didn't look at my show. The 32C tire seems to be the tire of choice. It has the most aerodynamic effect on the bike because the wider tire displaces more air. So therefore, the need for the deep dish aero rim is less necessary. But the other thing is that you're actually going to get more wattage out of the bike. So we're always looking for wattage on the bike, right? We want to figure out a way to get just a little bit more out of these legs because these legs just don't have that watts that they used to have. So it's always nice to get a little bit more wattage if you get a little more wattage. But anyway, that's probably the big thing that was observed here. So no more classic bikes, very few classic tires. So yeah, that's what's going on. There's just so many things that are changing in the industry. So if we take a look at this, no shift to super narrow bars. There's very few riders riding on narrow bars. And we're talking the sub 38 centimeters here. You'd have to have some fairly narrow shoulders to need something under 38 centimeters, I would think. But I tend to be a 40 centimeter guy. I use 42s on my cross bike because I want a little bit more control and stability on the bike, so that's what I do there. But you know, you're kind of looking at the width of your shoulders as far as what to do as far as handlebars go. So I think I've got Fran set up on 38s and I have 40s on my bike. So anyway, many riders still had their levers turned in. Some apparently appeared to be definitely beyond the UCI legal limit of 10 degrees, but many would go narrower even if they were given a choice. So anyway, that just makes no sense to me whatsoever. But I guess it's one of those things that, you know, we see for anybody who's looking for any way to get an extra watt or two out of their legs, that's one of the things they would possibly do. So that's bigger chain rings are becoming normal. Uh-oh, here we go, going back. So last year, the Belgian, there was a Belgian, Campenaerts made headlines when he was seen using a 62-tooth chain ring in a classified rear hub. The theory is that the larger chain ring abide by using a larger sprocket in the rear is more efficient. That's something we're regularly seeing in time trials too. This year, though, many riders are spotted using larger than standard chain sets. Cameron Arts himself was using a 58-42 setup. Ouch. And that just seems a little outrageous to me. And then another rider with a 54-41. We saw similar chain sets on Wout van Aert's bike, amongst others. 54-tooth chainring is certainly now the most popular choice. Taking a straw poll from the admittedly more than hilly Tour de Flanders, the chainrings there seemed on the whole to hover around 52-tooth. With cassettes becoming wider, running larger chainrings while looking incredibly cool, no longer represents the impossible gearing that it would be previously. It probably won't be trickling down to the consumer bikes anytime soon, but that's what they're doing. So this is weird to me. I just don't understand. So I would say that if you're using a big cog in the back, let's think about this just for a second. If you're using a much bigger cog in the back, okay, because that's the way a lot of these cassettes are being built now, and then you use the big chain ring in the front, like extra large chain ring in the front, I don't understand how they could be any more efficient. A gear inch is a gear inch, is it not? Anyway, if you have any comments to make on that, I am certainly willing to listen to what you have to say. All you engineers out there, pipe up right now, because I can't wait to hear the explanation of why a bigger gear in the front and a bigger gear in the back, being larger diameter in the back, would be more efficient than smaller. Maybe it's a friction thing? I'm not really sure. I don't get it. But anyway, to me, it sounds like a nasty cross-chain thing, which is just going to wear out your chain a lot faster. But, you know, that's just me talking. That's all. I don't know. I don't know these things. I don't keep totally up to date on this. Stage notes are a very personal thing. So people are putting handwritten notes on their stems and handlebars, probably as they are looking to know where, you know, a difficult part of the race might be or whatever, and maybe not relying on race radio to let them know, hey, this is the place you need to go, sort of thing. I have no idea, but The Lotti Capecchi from the current world champion had printed a set of stage notes on her stem, and who knows why, but they're on like a sticky canvas tape. So that was another thing that was observed in the pits at the current stage races. And let's see, women's teams happy to go off pista for saddles. What is this now? This one may take a little more surveying, but I think it's noteworthy, even from the small amounts of data that this person has. In the men's peloton, you see a wide variety of saddle models within a team, but can't recall ever seeing a saddle from the wrong brand. At Canyon SRAM, however, there are several specialized power saddles despite the team's Ergon sponsorship. While saddle sores affect men and have recently caused Tom Pidcock to abandon a race, men don't have the same soft tissue that women do, and it's heartening to see a team clearly prioritizing the comfort of their riders in spite of sponsorship arrangements. Oh, that's it. So they're riding on saddles that aren't their team-sponsored saddles. That's what's going on. So that's what's going on in the pits. That was the observation. The gear thing has me completely intrigued. I don't know if I want to even say it's intrigued. Confused, I think, is more like it. And I'm dying to hear of anybody that knows anything about this reasoning for the why a big chain ring on the front and a bigger cog in the back would be more energy efficient. I don't get it. But the big one, 32C tires. That's the big find right now, is 32C tires are the optimum wattage producing, or give you more wattage per for your ride than an old 28. Can't believe I'm calling a 28 an old. It doesn't seem that long ago that we were riding on 23C tires, does it? Anyway, I will tell you that the whole reason behind it, or one of the whole reasons behind it, and the reason why, if you have not gone this way yet, if you've not, you know, stepped off the ledge and made the jump, it's comfort, man. It's unbelievable. I ride my tires, my 28C tires, I ride them at 75 pounds in the front and 80 pounds in the back. Sometimes I actually even lower it a little bit more depending on the road surfaces I'm going to be on. But gosh, it just makes a bike ride a lot nicer. And you're not going to lose anything in efficiency. The tire is still very hard. Now, I'm not a big, heavy guy. I don't weigh a lot. So I'm not going to compress that tire very much. So obviously, there's going to be a difference for someone who has a few more kilograms than I have. So that's going to make a difference. But you know, try lowering the air pressure in your tires. It's amazing. It really does help a lot. I keep Fran's tires about the same level as mine are, and I haven't heard Fran complain about that. You ever complain about your tires being too soft, Fran?
No.
She just says, can you bless my bike before she goes out and rides it? That's all I hear. That's all I hear from Franny. So, anyway, We'll get on to more of the racing news here in a little bit as we get deeper into the show. So let me go back to where I was at here. So other things that we need to take a look at, rest days. How many rest days should a cyclist take each week? That's a good question, huh? I thought it was. And so I just keep getting more and more of these pieces of information thrown at me about riding slower to go faster, and it's like, not that I really need to go faster. I'm not racing a bike. I don't care how many miles per hour I ride on a ride. I more care that I'm out on a ride and enjoying the ride. That to me makes a lot more sense. So anyway, So the point here is, oh gosh, I've lost it here. Where is it here? Why rest, recovery, and tapering are necessary to get faster? That's a good question. This is from Trainer Road, and who obviously has some very, very good tips on training, nutrition, basic bike setup, all sorts of fun stuff. You can check them out at trainerroad.com, and they will give you more information on this. So optimizing rest days, recovery, workouts, and taper weeks translates to increased productivity during hard efforts. And knowing how to optimize your rest so that you can get faster and make the most of your training plan is essential. So there's obviously, if you want to know even more about this, I am not a professional trainer. I do not have the information you would need if you're looking for a good coach. There are lots of good coaches out there, and they can help you with this sort of thing, because they can also, by using items like heart rate and also power meters and all that, they can really dial in your work if you're looking for that sort of thing in your performance. But the key point here is a lot of people, and I see this more often than not, are they ride their bikes too hard, too fast, and too often. The two disease, as I like to call it. And when you do that, what ends up happening is your body will eventually start breaking down, because it's just not going to like to do that all the time. So avoid the two disease at all costs. Remember why you ride your bike. Maybe it's spring and you want to go out and smell some flowers or something. You know, just go have fun. Maybe you want to ride with your neighbor down the street because your neighbor down the street has expressed some interest in cycling, but they're completely intimidated by you and your Lycra skin suit, and you need to like take them out for a ride. That would be a great day to like not put the tight suit on, and maybe just a good pair of shorts, because that's always helpful, and just go out and ride at a pace that is let's say, back what it was when you first started riding your bike. And then you might hook somebody into the whole idea of cycling and getting into the sport, which is a good thing, instead of scaring them away. So what is that going to relate to as far as your quote-unquote training goes? It's going to relate to the easy day. Yeah, easy days. Easy days are great. I love easy days. My easy days are probably more the norm for me than the hard days are these days, just because that's the speed I'm going. And I'm also finding that, you know, if I'm watching, especially if I'm watching my heart rate carefully, and which I do that pretty much all the time now, as I had my heart incident a few years back, I'm very, very sensitive to what's going on inside this chest. So easy days are a good thing. And this is really tough for me this time of year, because I teach a lot of indoor classes. And because I teach a lot of indoor classes, and a lot of them are at a high level, aggressive nature, like a high intensity, you know, interval workout type of workout, or a HIIT workout, I need to be really, really aware of not going too hard while I'm teaching the class. Very easy to get sucked into it. You know, everybody's going hard in the class. People are hooting and hollering, and we're working super hard. And I'm trying to keep that enthusiasm level up, but I'm also trying very much to protect myself at the same time. So it can get tricky. It can get really, really tricky when you're doing that sort of thing. But I rely on my heart rate strap. I watch it like a hawk, and I keep my heart rate down for a lot of the workouts that I am teaching. I am not participating in the workout. I will participate in the workout two or three times a week, but I am very careful about not getting involved in it every single time I get on the bike. And, you know, that requires discipline. And it requires some patience. And it's not an easy thing to do, but I'm just looking to put some hours on my legs. I'm not really looking to put really hard work on the legs. I've got other things I can do that'll give me the hard work on the legs. So anyway, recovery weeks, rest days, taper weeks, they're a very, very essential part of your training. They might seem, you know, similar, and they might seem interchangeable, but you just really have to understand the importance of rest and how you can actively adjust your rest in correspondence to how well you recover and benefit from the productivity of your training and ultimately make you a faster cyclist. So how do you do it? Yeah, it's really, really tough. You have to really, it helps if you write things down. If it helps if you record information. If you're recording things, writing them down, maybe putting them on a spreadsheet so that you can reflect back on it in the future, that's a great way to tell. This is if you're doing it yourself. If you're not, if you've hired a coach and your coach is a good coach, they're probably doing this for you. So they're probably already looking at your stats from last year, and they're understanding that, you know what, last year we did this and you had a little burnout period, and you know what, we're going to do this year, we're going to adjust that so it doesn't happen. Everybody's different. Everybody is different. Everyone responds in a different way. So it's a tough thing to really dial in. But, you know, with time and experience on the bike, you can get better at it for sure. So recovery workouts are not just time fillers or junk miles. They have their own initial innate value and contribute to the productivity of your plan on a whole. During a recovery week, you may not feel as rested or recovered as you anticipated. In fact, recovery workouts might even feel a bit difficult. This is due to training stress accrued throughout the training block. So your recovery week, you may feel tired on the bike. You may feel that I'm taking it easy and I don't feel like I'm getting anything out of it. And if you feel fatigued during recovery weeks, don't worry. Stick to the training plan and get enough rest and active recovery so you could be feeling good and fresh for the following week. And that being said, when you complete each workout, pay attention to your body's response to the workload. If you feel the need to cut back on any of your workouts to shorten or lower the intensity, then err on the side of caution and do it. This is from a professional training website, okay? This is what they're recommending to their riders. Oftentimes, and I'm going to say more than not, I see people that are just going too hard. And unfortunately, when you do that, you take away the fun and the reason why you got into the whole bike thing in the first place, because it's fun. Unless you're some sort of creature that is, you know, different, and you're just like highly competitive and you really have to work out hard, you probably really got into cycling because cycling is a fun thing to do. Or maybe you just got into cycling because you started riding your bike back and forth to the office or to the grocery store or whatever and went, hey, this is kind of cool. I'm going to ride a little bit more. I'm going to go for a little longer ride on Saturday or whatever. Hopefully you didn't get into cycling to show up to the weekly ride and go out and try to kick some serious butt. Because if you did that, then now we need to talk a little bit more seriously about getting involved with a club, which is a racing club, and letting them show you and instruct you how to ride fast and safe at the same time. But anyway, It happens. It happens. Some of us have spent a lot of time on a bike, racing a bike, and we've learned a lot from it. And I am one of those. I did that for a number of years, and I found it very beneficial. I learned a lot. I had a great experience, and it gives me some good stories and some good times to think about. Do I still race? No. Do I still participate in sometimes aggressive rides? Yeah, sometimes, but it's not really my love. Let's put it that way. I just really like to go out and ride my bike. It's even like I'm going to be doing this. I'm going to be doing a ride with my friend Richard and his big gravel ride that's coming up here in March, and I am on the shorter distance ride, and basically, my duty there is to support the riders that are not aggressively off the front. It's really to support the riders that are falling back and to help them get through difficult parts of their ride and get them in safely. That's really what I do the best. So that's my stance as far as that goes. But those rides can get aggressive. They can get really, really tough. So you got to watch yourself there for sure. You definitely do. So recovery. It's so good. You can't get faster without going slower. Deep rest is less essential when you're doing endurance training, aka riding many miles. But when you hit those pedals hard, you suck your glycogen stores dry and break down muscle fibers. They cannot fully restock and repair if you keep stressing them. How about that? Isn't that an interesting thing? So, five reasons why you're not getting faster on your rides. This comes from Bicycling Magazine. Is this one of our, it's Celine Yeager, and she's got some great tips and training ideas and all that. You ride often, but mostly long and slow. This is number one reason. Cyclists often have a notion that putting big miles ought to automatically make them faster. And it's true that when you're just starting out, any miles make you faster because you're getting fitter. But once you've reached a certain point, piling on miles is just that, piling on miles. To go faster, you need to train your top end and boost your threshold so you can sustain higher speeds. So now we move on to fix it. How do you fix that? So here you are, you got into cycling, you're having a great time with it, you just want to ride more because, you know, you can feel yourself getting faster and it's great. And then all of a sudden one day you go out to go faster and you're not going faster anymore and you can't figure out why. Do speed work once or twice a week, mixing up eye-poppingly hard short intervals like Tabatas, 20 seconds full gas, 10 seconds rest, 8 times, 2 to 3 sets. I teach these in my indoor cycling classes. Longer tempo intervals would be from 10 to 20 minutes at about 75 to 85% of your maximum heart rate. So 5 minutes of recovery in between each of those. We did a workout last week. We did a Tabata workout in class last week, and I stressed the idea of running a little bit longer rest. And I know that because of the type of people that I have that take my indoor classes, they sometimes get bored with the rest stuff. So I had to figure out some creative ways to bring in some conversations or whatever that would keep them at that resting level a little bit longer. And when I did it, I had one of the riders come up to me afterwards and say to me, you know, I felt a lot better in that workout. I mean, it was really, really hard, but as it always is, but he said, you know, you mentioned at the end that you had increased the rest parts of it. And he said, I think it made a big difference. Well, it did make a big difference. That's how it works best. But it's really, really hard when you're teaching a high-level indoor cycling workout to get your riders to chill out for 5 minutes. And I'm talking about little to no pressure on the pedals whatsoever, dropping your heart rate down to 60% and keeping it there for a long period of time. A lot of times they get bored and they wanted to come in and work really hard for an hour. Well, you know what? I'm going to work you really hard for 16 minutes, but you're going to get a lot more out of it than if I worked you hard for that entire hour. So it's a hard thing to translate in an indoor class because people generally go there to get the bejesus beat out of them. I don't know what it is, but they go there and they just want to get worked really, really hard. But they're not doing themselves any good when they do that. So, you know, if you're doing a high intensity interval workout, making sure you get good rest in between is key. This rest word keeps popping up in my discussion all day today, but you know, it's just really good. So the next thing on Celine's list here is you don't do core work. So she says here, we talk core till we're blue in the face, but when I work with cyclists whose speed is getting zapped from back pain and fatigue, they're generally always neglecting their core the best. And she says she's guilty too. The folks who do their core work to get rid of pain and then drop it as soon as they feel better, but it doesn't work that way. You got to keep doing more core. You got to keep up the core. You got to keep up the habit of doing core. And core training is not pumping your tires up. Okay. You're pumping the tires. You maybe might be tightening your abs a little bit when you're doing it, but it's not that. That's not what you're looking for. No, core training. You need to really take a look at a good core type routine, planks, that sort of thing. If you get tired of the old moves, don't stop. Just switch it up. Try a different type of workout. You can do different things and there's a lot of information available as to different types of things you do to switch up your core, and it makes a big difference. You don't respect your rest is number 3 on the list. Boy, this word just keeps coming up, this nasty little 4-letter word called rest. You can't get faster without going slower. Here we go again. Deep rest is less essential when you're doing endurance training In other words, riding many hours. But when you hit those pedals hard, you suck the glycogen stores dry and break down muscle fibers. You can't fully restock and repair if you keep stressing them. As a rule of thumb, this is the fix. Make your easy rides as easy as your hard rides are hard. I like that. That's a good thing. If that's a struggle, spend your easy days off the bike and work your core instead. There you go. So I got to do an easy ride today, but I just really can't go easy. So don't ride at all. Stay off the bike. Stay off the bad habit. Don't do it. Number four on the list, you're focused mostly on weight loss. No, don't go there. Don't do it. So Celine says here, let's do a little math. Depending on your size, you can store about 1,700 to 2,000 calories of glycogen in your muscles and liver. Hard rides can torch up to 800 calories more if you're going really hard an hour. At that rate, it doesn't take long to drain the tank, and you're going to slow down as it approaches empty. Chances are good if you're counting carbs and calories, you're not starting out on full either, so you're starting your ride compromised. Even if you're a good fat burner, you'll go faster enough with glycogen on board. And she has here the fix it. Time your carbohydrate intake so you top off the tank before a hard ride and replenish it with what you've burned right after you are done. Drink a protein shake right after I get done all the time. It's like a religion with me. When you know you're going to be going really hard, think like cyclocross training or interval training or that sort of thing, fuel up with a carb-rich meal about 3 hours before. Something easily digestible like rice with a little chicken or oatmeal with nut butter. They're all good options. Then, about 15 minutes before you go, pop a few energy chews in to top off your tank. For longer, more tempo rides, you can eat closer to go time. Slug down some chocolate milk and a handful of mixed nuts afterward for carbs to restock and protein and repair. That's a good thing. And then here we go, number five on her list here. You neglect technique. You can be fit, relatively fast, but you still get dropped by equally fit and fast riders with better bike handling. Oh boy, this is a pet peeve. Fix it. Here's the fix. Really, really simple. Bike handling is something that you can and should work on regularly. Practice cornering, take a cyclocross clinic, perform pedaling drills. This is why the gravel riding craze is turned into a really, really good thing. I kind of snubbed my nose at the whole idea of gravel rides because I think they're silly, because it's like, why not just ride a cross bike, but because that's my background. But you know what? The gravel thing is really popular. People really like to do it, and it increases your bike skills. It really, really helps you with your bike skills because your bike is going to bounce around and it is not going to track completely straight in many, many conditions. It's going to be similar to that mountain bike that maybe you ride on or rode on a few years ago. Maybe you're still riding on it. You're going to learn how to handle and anticipate things that are going to happen while you're on the bike, and you're going to get better skills out of that. The other thing is with riding technique, you want to really perform some pedaling drills. Pedaling drills are going to be the ones where you really focus on pushing and pulling through the pedal stroke. I like to do them. I actually do them in my extreme classes on Sundays. We do one-legged drills, and I think they're very effective. I think if you can find a slight grade outside that is going up at, you know, anywhere from 1% to 3%, so if you were to stop pedaling, you would come to a stop, all right? But you know, it would take a little bit. That's the best place to do your pedaling drills. I like to do them on the rail trail right out back here because we have a classic 6 mile climb out here in northeastern Connecticut that is all 2% on the rail trail. So you can do your one-legged drills there and just, you know, do 20 seconds or 30 seconds on one leg and then switch over to the other leg, do the same thing. My preference on this is to not clip out the other leg, but to keep the other leg in place and really focus on the one that's doing all the work. That takes a little bit more concentration, and it's definitely harder to do for a lot of people, because a lot of people just can't shut the other leg off when they're riding. And if you can't, then you just use one leg. You just take a leg out, hold it out to the side, and do your one leg drill that way. But it really, really helps, because it'll teach you how to really pedal the bike. And a lot of people know how to ride a bike, but nobody knows how to ride a bike. They have to learn as they go along. And you learn from talking to old cranky guys like me, and maybe, you know, figuring a few things out on your own. Maybe you read some stuff that Celine Yeager talks about here in Bicycling Magazine. She's very good. So anyway, that's it. That's I'm going to move on to another topic here. And so the big thing here I started out with was the state of New Jersey being absolute idiots about.
Hey.
Well, you know, it's like they are. This is silly. So this is why every e-biker is worried about New Jersey's proposed micro-mobility insurance law. So this comes from Streets Blog, and it caught my ear and my eye when I'd heard something on a radio podcast or something, and then I went and looked into this and I found out a little bit more. So this bill is to require micro mobility users to carry a form of liability insurance that doesn't even exist yet. And so on Thursday, this goes back a few weeks, New Jersey Senate's Transportation Committee is holding a hearing about Bill S2292, which would require riders of low-speed electric bikes and scooters to register their vehicles with the state and carry liability insurance to cover themselves and anyone else who might be harmed in the event of a crash. I wonder how they feel about people who pedal bicycles faster than people who can ride e-bicycles. Anyway, the bill is sponsored by the Senate President Nicholas Scutari and is expected to pass. Serious crashes involving those modes are so relatively rare, though, that the National Transportation Safety Board recorded just 119 e-bike involved fatalities between 2017 and 2021 versus the 192,709 caused by drivers. That advocates say legislation would do little more than increase already steep barriers to human-scaled mobility posed by traffic violence while undermining the climate equity and safety goals that low-speed modes can help communities reach. This is a very, I see this as a very, I don't know how to put this, but almost like an income-based prejudice, because, you know, there's people that ride the e-bikes for transportation. This is how they get around. It's what they can afford. And versus somebody who maybe they can't afford to go out and buy a $40,000 motorized vehicle, but they can go out and buy a $4,000 electric e-bike. And you know, I mean, this is really privilege based. I don't like it at all. So it makes sense to me, because the insurance industry, as I did a little bit more discovery on this, I found that the insurance industry is looking at doing this because they're finding, and this is good news for us, those of us who ride bicycles, is really, really good news. We're riding bicycles more and driving our cars less. Well, there's a couple of factors here. Number one, when you drive your car less, that means you're putting less miles on per year. If you're putting on less miles per year, then what you have is a way of lowering your insurance rates. So if you are lowering your insurance rates, you are therefore not paying the insurance company as much money as you would if you were driving more. So this is definitely a problem. I am having a reconnect problem with my Facebook Live. I hope that you're still seeing this, but I'm not real sure.
It's been in and out.
Anyway, it's been in and out. So anyway, there will be an audio version of this available, and it will be available on WHUS so you can hear the whole thing. But anyway, so that's one thing that's going on. The other thing that's going on is some people are just saying, you know what? I'm done with the car. I'm done with the truck. I am going to change my life. I am going to change my priorities, and I'm going to ditch the car, and I'm not going to use it anymore. And that is turning into numbers in the insurance industry. So now what do? Well, let's make people by legislation, this is what's going on in New Jersey, let's make them buy liability insurance for riding a bicycle. Foul. Did I say foul? Very foul. Very nasty. New Jersey, get your act together. This is not a good idea at all. Not a good idea. I'm not super happy about it. And, you know, there's other states that are offering e-bike incentives to get people on e-bikes, and New Jersey is now going to fine you for riding an e-bike. Not good. Not good. I'm not super happy about this whole idea. So that's why it came out in my rant. That's why I wanted to talk about this week, and it's not a good thing. So the Garden State already requires licenses and registrations for owners of Class 3 e-bikes, which can go up to 28 miles an hour. Maybe that might be where we stretch the edge of this a little bit. But the coalition says the state has struggled to implement and enforce the rule because there's simply no process to it. Meanwhile, Class 1 and Class 2 e-bikes are the focus of a new bill and are both capped at 20 miles per hour, and as are most e-kick scooters, and would also be impacted. So I just don't understand. And I guess what it really comes down to is I'm not the big corporation that's maybe looking at the possibility of a loss of revenue that maybe means that I might have to, you know, drop my CEO's salary by, I don't know, $2 or $3 million a year. This just makes me angry when I read stuff like this. The number of e-bike crashes is so small compared to the millions of car crashes per year, and yet here they go. They want to just start tagging onto e-bikes. This looks like an opportunity to me for someone in corporate America to make just a little bit more money. And so I don't like this a whole lot, and it's very, very unfortunate. And apparently the folks at Streets Blog aren't super psyched about it either, and that's why this was brought up. So it just really seems like something that we should be looking in other directions, but we're going to move on to something else here, and I'm going to talk a little bit about let's see here. Where did I find it? So here is the New Jersey Senate proposal. I did find this on the Bicycle Coalition of Greater Philadelphia. If you're looking for it, you can find it right there. That's bicyclecoalition.org and you'll /NJ-state. So if you go there, you will find that you'll find a lot more about this, and it'll talk exactly about that micromobility bill S-4132. And it does, it gets into the specifics of that. So this requires anybody with an e-bike to have a liability insurance protection of up to $35,000. And that just seems, it just seems rude, and it seems very, very class oriented. And this is not a good thing. How long is it going to take for them to make a decision that it's no longer about the powered bicycles, but it's about the human-powered bicycles too? I mean, what's the difference? If I can take my human-powered bicycle and do the same thing as someone with an e-powered bicycle, why am I different? I don't think it's going to take much longer for them to start requiring liability insurance on all bicycles, and that has me very, very concerned. We're going to keep our eyes on this and see what happens, because it just really doesn't make a lot of sense. And it seems like it is something that could certainly face a lawsuit that would end its beginning. That would be a really good thing. So I would say that we need to do other things instead. Okay, here's a better idea. You want to hear a better idea? This goes back to something I had mentioned earlier, that there was a study: pausing at intersection just drops pedestrian accidents by 47%. This is like kind of a in the world of Ron and Fran, we call this a DUH moment. And yeah, you slow down, you go to an intersection, you have less chance of hitting someone. Huh? Really? You think? Yeah. People don't slow down. People don't slow down when they pass me on in their cars when I'm riding my bike on the road. They don't slow down. I mean, some do. I'll give some people credit. Some people do. Some people actually, you can hear the vehicle slowing down behind you. And I have others where all I hear is them speeding up when they see me, because they've got to get around me, because, you know, they're late for, you know, the open heart surgery that they're about to perform. I don't know why they're so, what's so important to them that they have to feel that they get around me so much faster. If you really feel that that's the way you need to drive, maybe you should leave the house a little earlier in the morning. Just a suggestion, that's all. So the International Drivers Association says pausing at intersections can greatly reduce pedestrian accidents. This will also go in relation to bicycling accidents, which is why I'm talking about it on Bicycle Talk. This is not rocket science. This is, we all need to take a pause and slow down. I didn't put the other two words in that I wanted to put in, because this is a clean show and I'm kid friendly. So anyway, that's what really has to happen here. You don't need to be going that fast in that vehicle. There is a speed limit on your road. That speed limit was put there as a recommendation to keep everyone safe. Not just you who are driving your monster vehicle down the road, but also to all others that are sharing the road with you. And this is something that I am not seeing this, and I am seeing a high increase of, and I'm also reading about high increase of aggressive driving behavior, which has been on the increase since the COVID virus hit us. And people are just, they're angry, they're driving fast, and everyone is in their way, no matter what. I drove up to my local community center this morning in the dark, because it's dark out this time of year still, and it was too cold for me to be riding my bike. It was 28 degrees, and that's below my limit. And as I'm driving up, I was driving about 5 miles per hour over the speed limit, which is, you know, it's early in the morning. I wasn't too concerned about that, but I was 5 miles an hour over the speed limit, and I had 12 cars that were sitting on my rear end in the 3 mile stretch I was on the state highway. 12. I counted them this morning. It just angers me to no end. It's 5:30 in the morning. It's not even, these people aren't even awake yet. And yet they're tailgating me all the way up a state highway, and you know, some often pass me because they feel I'm going too slow. Just slow down. Start earlier. Whatever you got to do, you know, doesn't make sense. You're already up at 5:30. Who cares? Get up a little bit early. Not that big a deal. So anyway, it's slow down. You'll make us all safer. So let's move on here real quick. We got a couple more things I cannot talk about because I am going to have to table these for next week, including the weekend season openers, the Umloop van Nesblad and the Kern-Brussel-Kern, which both were dominated by the what we used to call the Jumbo-Visma crowd, but now they're the Visma bike something else. I can't remember what they are. But anyway, that's basically the Visma team is just dominating right now. And Wout van Aert is part of that, and we'll hear a lot more about it. But right now, we got to move on because we got to go into events and talk about a few things. The Fatty Cross was at Haddam Neck this past weekend. I heard they had a pretty good turnout. That's pretty cool. And the Frozen Four Road Race Training Series is starting on Sunday, March 3rd, and that is 4 weeks of training races in Farmington, Connecticut. If you're interested in getting involved in bike racing, this is a great place to do it because it generally is safe, it's on a closed course, and that's a good thing. The Philly Bike Show Expo is March 16th through the 17th in the Pennsylvania Convention Center. Sort of is a, I would call it a very, very strong consumer show. It's a pretty neat thing. And if you want to see what a whole bicycle trade show thing is, the idea of it, that's a great place to go to. And of course, the People for Bike Leadership Conference is March 26th through the 29th in Tucson, Arizona. And I'll have more information on that next week because I just got a list of things that they were going to be discussing and people who are going to be there. And I'll try to get over that next time. The Handmade Show is in Portland, Oregon, August 23rd through the 25th. And also for my Australian listeners, there's one on June 28th through the 29th, which is kind of cool. And my screen just went crazy on me here. So anyway, what else have I got? The Natchog Epic Domestique Sports. Yeah, it's coming up. It was, it is a dirt road ride, and it is a, it does have some points along the way where you can, timed points along the way, which are kind of cool. Last week, I told you there were 547 pre-registered. This week, today, as of the beginning of this show, it's up to 619, and the Epic, with the men's Epic, which is closes out at 300 riders, is at 298. If you're listening to this right now, you might be able to get into that because the field is not going to exceed 300. None of the fields are. So they're already at 619 and it's over 3 weeks away. So you might just want to give it a shot if you want to do it. This is definitely important. 2024 Ride of Silence is Wednesday, May 15th, rain or shine, 7 p.m. sharp. It will start and finish at the Mansfield Town Hall, town building, and community center, and you extra overflow parking will be at E.O. Smith High School. We are expecting a crowd this year. Finishing points, it's warming up, warming trend. Yay, we like warming trends. We might hit 50, and that maybe tomorrow. That'll be a cool thing. Cycling makes you happy and is good for you. I guess that's another one of those DUH moments. I keep mentioning it because it's a good thing to mention. And of course, go Huskies. Yeah, we'll move on that. And we do love the listeners' comments, so please keep them coming. So 2024, more miles, ride to commute to work, around town, better fitness, or simply enjoying the bicycle rides you take more by slowing down and smelling the roses. I'll say it again, it won't be my last time. Get loud, get active, our time has come. Stop complaining about traffic, dangerous roads, and the price of gas, and the lack of places to safely ride, and join the revolution of change. Hey, take a day, park the car or truck, and go ride your bike instead. You might just surprise yourself. The views expressed in this program do not reflect the views of the staff, management, or licensee of this station. You have been listening to Bicycle Talk with my friendly co-host, the lovely Dr. Fran Storch. If you're watching on Facebook Live, please feel free to comment below, or you can just send me an email at bicycletalk1@gmail.com. You can also listen to past episodes of Bicycle Talk on whus.org, iTunes, Spotify, and now on my Bicycle Talk YouTube channel. If you'd like to contribute information to the show or be on the show as a guest, just send me an email. This is Pedalin' Ron. Remember, keep that rubber side down, the wind at your back. Get out and ride your bike. It just might save your life. This is 91.7 FM, WHUS Stores, and WHUS.org. Thank you so much for listening. See you next week. Get on your bikes and ride!